This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Donald Trump's election has sparked dramatic growth in recruitment for left-wing political organizations, including the Workers' World Party, which held its national conference in Newark, New Jersey.
But first, the Democratic Party and the U.S. corporate media have spent more than a year trying to blame the Russians for the myriad crises that afflict the United States. Anti-Russia hysteria has reached McCarthy-era levels. Left-wing journalists have been targeted for blacklisting and accused of spreading fake news. Juliana Tweeden reports on the intersection of technology and socioeconomic issues. She recently wrote an article for In These Times magazine titled, How the Fake News Scare is Marginalizing the Left.
The fake news narrative that began to circulate shortly after the 2016 election, certainly it extended to tech companies, Google, Facebook, Twitter, and these companies came under more scrutiny because they have such media monopolies. They play such instrumental roles in disseminating the media that people see. And so after some kind of accusations and narratives arose that they were complicit in disseminating misinformation, a lot of these sites began to take action. So Facebook added features where users could report what they deemed to be fake news. Google expanded its fact-checking apparatus and began to control for some of the ads it deemed dubious. But one of the casualties that resulted from this was Google updated its algorithms in at least April. And after that update, many left-wing sites reported that they saw their search traffic plummet. And obviously, this is connected to Google because Google has a search monopoly. So the World Socialist website said it saw a 67% dip in search traffic between April and July. Other sites like Alternet, Democracy Now!, Common Dreams, the World Socialist website reported that they saw significant declines ranging from 49 to 71%. So clearly, it seems like something is amiss, that Google's algorithmic updates and other tech companies' algorithmic updates that are supposed to be in accordance with controlling for fake news are actually stifling sites that are more likely to publish dissenting views.
I can report, for example, that when I would Google my own stories on subjects like mass black incarceration, previously they would fill up a whole page. And now I'm lucky to get one citation from Google, from Black Agenda Report, although my articles pop up with more frequency when they appear on sites that have not been blacklisted.
And I think that certainly relates to a lot of the updates that Google made, because, you know, in contrast with the declines that I mentioned earlier, you know, it's like the Washington Post and the New York Times haven't seen anywhere near the same declines. The Washington Post still talks about getting up to 90 some million monthly visitors. And there's a journalist, Chris Hedges, who wrote for Truthdig that internet users doing searches on Google, since the algorithms were put in place, are diverted from such sites as Truthdig and directed to mainstream publications like the New York Times. So there certainly absolutely appears to be a skew towards centrist corporate media and an obscuring of lefty sites.
In arguments before the FCC, the conventional media, that is the folks who used to have the monopoly, is certainly in broadcasting. And there is, of course, a great overlap now between broadcast and print conglomerates. They used to defend this monopoly by saying that social media was on the rise and all these alternative viewpoints could find a place in the sun on social media. But now that sun is setting as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, what's interesting is that I think the fake news narrative, while it's been kind of manipulated in many different ways because it is so vague, but at least in kind of its modern sense, it originated, I feel like, in 2016 when possibly 2015, Facebook was stifling right-wing sites, and there was an uproar over that. And then it began to compensate for that, and it began to publish more right-wing news. And then so much of that was misleading, so much of that right-wing news was inaccurate, that that's when the term, in its, again, in its most modern sense, really began to kind of surface. So again, the term fake news has been manipulated ever since. Obviously, the DNC kind of appropriated it to try to grapple with the election of Donald Trump and avoid any sort of introspection of the Democratic Party. But yes, the social media's involvement in displaying news is completely subjective. And social media companies like Facebook and Twitter, again, have pretty much entirely full control over the sites that they do choose to display. And so lefty sites have suffered as a result of this. And I think, you know, a lot of this relates to the politics of social media companies like Facebook and Twitter. I think ProPublica has done reporting talking about the racist ad platforms that Facebook has, where Facebook has violated in the past the Fair Housing Act and has allowed advertisers to choose the races to which they advertise. And Twitter has had, as I think anyone who uses Twitter regularly might know, Twitter has verified Nazis and has displayed white supremacist organizations' ads. So you mentioned the idea that lefty sites would find a home on social media, but I think in a narrative like that, that the FCC once pushed, it very much neglects the idea that these tech companies do have their own politics and that those political agendas seep through to the news that they choose to display.
You know, some of us think that in addition to the term fake news, we ought to coin the term fake numbers, because when Google alters its algorithms and produces a different kind of statistical reality, they are offering fake numbers, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, I think it's easy enough to manipulate the information that they might display. And I think also, if we're talking about fake numbers, I think another interesting point to mention is that if we're talking about the Facebook ads that were alleged to be from Russian actors who wanted to manipulate the election, there has been kind of this exaggeration of how effective and how far-reaching these ads have been. So, for example, the Facebook ads that were alleged, again, to be from Russian actors looking to tamper with the election results, there are only 3,000 of them, $100,000 worth, and that's out of multi-billion dollar ad market. While the Twitter accounts that were suspected to be Russian were only numbered 200, and that's out of 328 million total accounts. So while, you know, Google might be manipulating numbers, there's also kind of manipulation of numbers with this entire narrative that, again, that these tech companies are platforms for Russian influence on American users.
And certainly Russia must be a superpower of some kind if it can have such a profound effect on U.S. elections and politics in general while spending the equivalent of the price of one luxury car, $100,000.
Exactly, exactly. With, again, within the context of a $6.8 billion election and a multi-billion dollar company, I just read that 98% of Facebook's revenue is from ads. It takes in many, many, many billions of dollars in ads every year. And there was one analysis, I think, that said that there were some ads that were purchased for $1.10. And I also know that the journalist Max Blumenthal talked about how some of the Russian ads were of puppies. So you can have a very long conversation about the political dubiousness of many of these ads and how exaggerated their influence has been in terms of both numbers and in terms of content.
It seems that when they could not drudge up enough ads that were pro-Trump, they then expanded the search and said they were discovering all these ads that came down on all sides of various issues. And so then the charge became that the Russians were trying to sow general divisions in U.S. society. And now we have this Democratic Congressman Schiff, who's on point in Russiagate, who is talking about taking measures to bar or ban or curtail messaging that appeals to what he calls fear and anger, as if that can be outlawed.
Right, exactly. As if that can be measured and, let alone outlawed. Again, there's a large kind of technocratic push to control for this problem. I know that a few senators have proposed the Honest Ads Act, which would require tech companies to disclose who purchased ads. It's similar regulation to political advertising on TV and on radio and in print. So there are politicians who are trying to kind of very softly legislate this. But a lot of the steps they're taking are very impotent and are just very toothless and technocratic, just very incremental. It's nothing that will come close to solving whatever problem they think exists. Like, as you mentioned with Adam Schiff, trying to determine which ads instill fear and anger and which ads appeal to fear and anger. These things cannot be quantified, and they certainly can't be legislated. So there is just this really kind of hand-wringing, clueless approach to trying to control for whatever problem, certainly the DNC has been deeming is the case. But still, they are allowing such a long leash on these tech companies. They're still giving them so much power to regulate what kind of content is disseminated and, you know, what people see. And there's not going to be any sort of meaningful change with the proposals that senators and other politicians have set forth. Again, it's just more incremental steps. It's more trying to solve a problem that hasn't even really been defined. Again, the fake news issue, the Russiagate issue, these are not things that have been proven. They're not things that are objective. They're not measurable in any way. And it's all just a bunch of kind of spinning their wheels and creating problems that distract from the real problem.
You know, American elections are not based usually on issues. They are, in fact, based on fear and anger and other subjective kinds of battles.
Right. And, you know, emotions like that certainly just don't really have a place in this kind of regulation, again, because these are not things that are measurable. They're not things that can be controlled for. And you mentioned the, quote, divisive nature of many of these ads and how they were alleged to have supported politicians other than Trump, which just, I think, is further evidence that this argument does not have legs, that saying that these ads sow discord is not a productive or well-conceived argument, because what does that really mean? What is the purpose of sowing discord, and how does that lead to accomplishing whatever mystical Russian goal there was, namely that goal of electing Donald Trump? This idea of creating chaos just doesn't really seem to jibe with the rest of the argument. And so relying on all these really vague concepts of chaos and fear and anger and thinking that there is not only perpetuating that narrative, but also thinking that there is some way to control for that. It's all just very baseless and just horribly unfounded and confused.
I know you're not a legal reporter, but Google does have a monopoly, and algorithms are supposed to measure something that can be quantified. Is there anything actionable, do you believe, in Google's actions, which measurably have had an impact on the viability of a lot of left-wing sites?
You mean in terms of taking legal action against Google?
Yes.
I think that's certainly a possibility. I don't know what many of these kind of left-leaning sites are planning to do to combat this. They've reported on the problem, but I'm not entirely sure what their next approach will be. I think they have grounds to take legal action. But again, unfortunately, all that would lead to, I think, is, you know, a few probably more technocratic changes. Google would still have a monopoly. And, you know, therein lies the problem, that this giant private company has a monopoly over this very, very useful service, search engines, essentially a universal utility. So there is the possibility of these sites taking legal action, which could do some good. But again, it unfortunately is not enough, I think, to address the real issue, which is that, again, this giant private company has a monopoly and this giant private company has a ton of control over what information we can see.
And Google would certainly assert its proprietary rights over the algorithms and say that we would not even have the right of discovery to see what they had done to put their fingers on the scale.
Yes, absolutely. And that brings to mind a conversation with Eric Schmidt, who is the chairman of Google's parent company, Alphabet, who has talked about the possibility of detecting fake news preemptively. In an interview, he talked about how computers should be able to detect, he said, malicious, misleading, and incorrect information, and essentially have you not see it. So Eric Schmidt was talking about Google having the power to preemptively remove content that it deemed fake news, that it deemed misleading, misinformation. He said, we're not arguing for censorship, we're arguing just take it off the page. And so what he's implying there is that, well, he would very much be interested in censoring content, but he's not calling it censorship. He's viewing it as some sort of noble deed, I think, you know, that this company is making the decisions for us so that their users don't have to be exposed to fake news in the first place. So this is, at least with Google, this seems to be the direction that they think things should go in. So Google is not looking to minimize its power. Obviously, most tech companies are highly hostile to regulation. Google is looking to increase its power and, again, to not start to remove what's deemed fake news after it's been reported, but rather to do it before it's even been seen. So this does not bode well.
Most people know that the internet itself came into existence as partially a product of the Defense Department. And now with this crackdown on the left, it appears that the ruling class is taking back its internet.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think once the internet became privatized, things really just began to balloon. And, you know, now the primary functions of the internet are commerce and advertising. And so, yes, absolutely. Billionaires have as much control over the internet as they want. Every major tech company is owned by a billionaire, and many of them have achieved monopolies online. So, yes, that's exactly the current state of the internet. I think there are a couple of really delusional and really dangerous narratives that are happening in the story that I wrote. One is, you know, the Russiagate fake news narrative, and the other is, I think, relying upon technology companies to control for the information that they disseminate that relates to that narrative. So on the one hand, we have corporate Democrats who will not accept how isolating their party has gotten and are refusing to be introspective. I know that obviously this is a conversation that's been had ad nauseum, but we haven't seen any changes. And so it's a conversation that still needs to be had. And meanwhile, there's this technocratic approach of relying upon these monopolistic tech companies that have been proven to have incredibly toxic politics, that have proven that they are in no position to be regulating the political content that we see. The only things that various senators who are interested in controlling for, again, what they deem to be fake news and what they deem to be Russian infiltrators, the only things they're proposing are transparency over ads. And the only steps that we've seen from Google and Facebook and Twitter are very small tweaks. Again, slightly more ad regulation, options to flag fake news from users. As I mentioned before, it's just these incredibly kind of impotent, technocratic, just toothless approaches, ultimately that will do nothing to control for whatever problems these politicians have invented. And ultimately, it's just going to result, I think, in more collusion between tech companies and the government, just these incredibly damaging forces. And again, relying on technology companies to control political content is a harbinger of doom, again, because of just the incredibly noxious politics that we've seen from companies like Facebook, Twitter, and Google.
Yes, people have long called those folks in Silicon Valley masters of the universe, and now they seem to be the arbiters of truth.
Exactly. Sadly enough.
That was journalist Julianne Tweeden.
The election of Donald Trump was considered bad news by most folks on the left, but radical political organizations have experienced dramatic increases in recruitment since Trump moved into the White House. That's certainly true for the Workers' World Party, which held its national conference in Newark, New Jersey. The conference coincided with the 50th anniversary of the Newark Rebellion of 1967. The Workers' World Party was welcomed to Newark by Larry Hamm, chairman of the People's Organization for Progress, which has been fighting for social justice for more than three decades.
I welcome you to Newark, New Jersey, Brick City, on the 50th anniversary of the 1967 Newark Rebellion. Fifty years ago, I was 13 years old, a little boy living at 527 South 12th Street in Newark, New Jersey. And on the night of July 13th, somebody said, Springfield Avenue is on fire. And that night, the police had stopped a black cab driver, John Smith. They stopped him, I believe, at Fairmount and Springfield Avenue. And they dragged him to the 17th Avenue precinct, which is still there today. A police precinct that had a notorious reputation. It was known that if you were taken into that police station alive, you might not come out and you might be carried out. And when the police beat Smith and took him to the police station, people thought that that was his fate. And shortly thereafter, grassroots organizations had a demonstration in front of that 17th Avenue precinct. And that demonstration led to a confrontation between the police and the demonstrators in the Hayes Home Housing Project. That police station was in the center of, at that time, the most populous black community in the United States. More black people lived within the square mile that contained Stella Wright, Scudder Homes, and Hayes Homes than any other place in the United States. People could literally look out of their windows down onto the police station where they saw the demonstration. And that demonstration and that confrontation led to the 1967 unrest in this city. Now, some people call it a riot, but in the People's Organization for Progress, which for 30 years has called it something else, and most people in Newark today don't call it a riot. If it had been a riot, it had been something that could have been put down, Brother Ezekiel, by the police in Newark. But the 1,300-member police force could not put it down. And Governor Hughes had to declare a state of emergency. He sent in 700 state troopers, and the police and the state troopers could not put it down. And then, when all else failed, they called in the Army. They called in the National Guard. 1,500 National Guardsmen, 700 state troopers, 1,300 police, and for 5 days, the people of Newark rose up against racist repression. For 5 days, we fought back, and that is why we do not call it a riot. We call it a rebellion. It was the Newark Rebellion of 1967. But it wasn't the only rebellion. It wasn't even the first rebellion here in New Jersey. The whole period was a period of uprisings. From 1960 to 1971, there were more than 1,000 urban uprisings in the United States, more than 1,000 urban uprisings. In this state, there were 27, every major city. The first uprising was in 1966 in Jersey City. But that caught fire, and then there was an uprising in Plainfield, and just rising up wasn't enough. They seized the armory and the weapons in Plainfield, and nobody was killed in the Plainfield Rebellion. That period was a period of revolutionary fervor, and it gave added impetus to the Black Power movement. This city was an apartheid city. It was a majority Black city controlled by a white minority and a white political structure. And people had had enough. Enough was enough. And they rose up. And in 1966, there was an attempt to elect a Black mayor, but it failed. And people say there was so much destruction in North. They say millions of dollars. They say how terrible that was. But I say it was not terrible. Property may have been destroyed, but people's consciousness was transformed, and it was the uprising of 1967 that led to the movement to smash racial apartheid in Newark and elect the first Black mayor, Ken Gibson, in 1970. In this hotel, where we sit right now, was the victory celebration. It was like the election of Nelson Mandela. I kid you not, when Gibson was elected in 1960, Black people literally danced down the street, because we had brought political apartheid to an end in this city. And where we're sitting now was where the victory celebration was held. And that Black Power movement did not end in 1970. In 1974, we elected a predominantly Black city council. And in 1971, students marched out of a high school led by somebody named Larry Hamm. And we marched down to the Gateway Hotel, right across the street from Penn Station. Many of you probably saw it. 500 of us marched. 200 of us got inside, took over the fifth and sixth floors of the Gateway. And the mayor had to come and talk to us. And as a result of that student power movement, a young man named Larry Hamm, 17 years old, appointed to the Newark Board of Education, the youngest person to serve on a school board in the history of the United States of America. So I welcome you to Newark on this 50th anniversary. And I am cheering about the slogan for your conference, yes, we must smash white supremacy, and we must smash capitalism. There's no ifs, ands, and buts about it. And I welcome our comrades from Durham who have been vilified in the press, who've been called criminals for their action. But what they did in Durham, pulling down the symbols of white supremacy, was not a crime. It was a revolutionary act, and they are revolutionary heroes. And in the 2 minutes I have left, how could I leave this podium and not say at least a word about this being the 100th anniversary of the great October proletarian revolution? I am not afraid to stand here and celebrate with you what happened in 1917, Because although some of us and most of us probably lament what has happened in the last decade, the fact of the matter is that the October proletarian revolution was one of the greatest historical events in the emancipation of humanity from exploitation. And so we celebrate that great event. But we are not here today. You have not gathered here for your party conference to celebrate the past. You've come to discuss the present and to plan for the future. Now more than ever before, we must unite the progressive forces in this country. During World War II, a united front was formed to defeat fascism. And we see a fascist movement arising in this country today. And just as a half century ago, people had to unite to defeat fascism in the world, we must unite the progressive forces to defeat fascism and the racist, fascist Trump regime that is in Washington, D.C. today. So let us build a movement against war. War is the enemy of all humanity. War is killing children all over the world. War is causing untold suffering. U.S. imperialism is engaged in more than 60 military operations in countries all over the world. War is the enemy of humanity. And we must build a movement to harness the greatest advocate of war today, which is U.S. imperialism. We must bring U.S. imperialism to an end and harness the great resources of our nation for the benefit of humanity. In a country this wealthy, there's no reason why we can't have universal health care for every citizen. In a country this wealthy, there's no reason why students have to become indentured servants to the banks with $30,000 and $40,000 of loans. We should have free college education for every young person in the United States of America. So I thank you, Workers' World Party, for coming to Newark, for having this conference, and let us unite and build a movement of all humanity, of all races, of all human beings to build a better world for all people in this country and in the world today. Power to the people!
That was Larry Hamm of the People's Organization for Progress. Workers' World Party First Secretary Larry Holmes noted that his party has experienced dramatic growth since the election of Donald Trump.
When I look out at this audience and I hear the speeches and I hear about how many people are looking at the live stream, and I don't know how many people are outside of the United States, I think of this, and this is what Marcyites were taught. You know, the first time they heard Comrade Marcy speak, once or twice or three or four times, one way or another it came out, whether he was talking about Africa, whether he was talking about the Black Liberation Movement, whether he was talking about Vietnam or Cuba or anything. And that was that the oppressed of this planet, the workers and the oppressed, are waiting for the multinational working class at the center of imperialism to wake up and show signs that not only is it alive, but it is ready to kick some ass and change Change the objective situation on the planet. Change what they used to call the relationship of forces. This is a big concept. We believe it's true. When you look at Zimbabwe, who imperialism has been starving, certainly whatever's happening there, that has had something to do with it, because they hate liberation. When you look at our comrades in Venezuela and how they're starving Venezuela, look at what they're doing to Puerto Rico. It's supposed to be part of the U.S. It's a colony. If anybody didn't realize that, they certainly realize that now. When you look at the oppressed in any part of the globe, the Middle East, look what they've done to the Middle East. They've devastated the Middle East. They bombed many countries literally back into the Stone Age. Look what they did to Libya. What a crime. We could move on. We could move on to Asia, to the Americas, and to Newark, and Detroit. Look what they did to Detroit. Look what they did to Brooklyn. If the workers and the oppressed of this country were strong and had a strong revolutionary party that reflected their strength, that channeled their strength, this would not be. This would not be. The oppressed everywhere would have a loyal ally. And what we do would have an immediate and positive impact on their struggle. That hasn't been the case. We've done what we can. Others have done what we can. Generally, it's been symbolic. What I'm trying to say is that now we're in a development where it must go beyond symbolism. It must change the equation. Our comrades in the DPRK, what we call People's Korea, they have a right to defend themselves with nuclear weapons. We must defend that. That said, I wish the case was that they knew that we would shut this country down and burn the Pentagon to the ground if there was even a whisper. If there was even a whisper that the generals were going to carry out some unimaginable attack on Asia. We can't do that yet, but we're changing. This is what changes things. The growth, the political development of the workers and the oppressed in the United States, what we all call the belly of the beast, this is what's happening. This is the objective process. Finally, years ago, decades ago, many decades ago, 60, 70 years ago, Sam talked about it in terms of we've been relying, let's face it, we've been relying on the national liberation movements, on the Soviet Union. Talk about the Soviet Union. Would things have worked out the way that they did? Might there still be a Soviet Union if the working class at the imperialist centers was strong and revolutionary and united? No one can answer that question, but it's a damn good question. Finally, what's happening to us is a reflection of something much bigger. I know that it's easier to digest and understand things if you dice it up. And that narrowness is necessary, you know, just like we look at things locally before we look at things regionally, nationally, and globally. But this is a time, comrades, to stop for a moment, even if it's only for a moment, and think globally and think historically. Because what our growth reflects is a world situation, a world situation, and we have more responsibility. And as revolutionaries, it is our obligation to open our eyes, to understand that responsibility, and to shoulder it. There will be no revolution if we don't understand this. But I am confident that we will. A related, very much related process. The election of Trump is a contradictory development. All of us understand one side of it. It's a massive attack on the oppressed, on black and brown people, on women, on Muslims, on lesbian, gay, bi, trans, and queer people, and on the poor. It's also on the entire working class. But, you know, I'm talking about the initial picture. Actually, it's an effort to smash our class into 1,000 pieces so that we're less able to fight capitalism. And all of the things that comrades have talked about, what's going on with the tax breaks for the rich and the corporation, and how it's a transfer of wealth from whatever's left in, you know, social programs at a national and local level, just defund all that counter-revolution and give it to the rich, and how this is probably a great idea and a great strategy for a struggle around that. That's very true. And there's so many other things that are happening, healthcare, whatever, you know. But there's another side of the contradiction of Trump's election. It's a sign that capitalism is failing. It's a sign that its political system is slowly falling apart. Actually, not so slow. It's a good sign. It's part of a contradiction. And the message it should send to revolutionaries everywhere, especially here in the belly of the beast, it's like when the shark smells blood. This system is falling apart. They have a buffoon for president. It is, I mean, when I say buffoon, I don't want to suggest that he's not dangerous. But I'm talking about from the point of view of them. You know, it's part of their split. It's part of their craziness. It's part of their, you know, falling apart, that somehow they've got, you know, this bumbling buffoon as a president that speaks for powerful U.S. imperialism. I'll tell you, there's a sector of the ruling class that can't look in the mirror. They just, it's bizarre. It's unimaginable. They don't believe it. They talk about it on CNN and MSNBC, and I don't think anybody listens. You know, because the workers and the oppressed don't listen to them anymore. Actually, his election, to some extent, it's a sign of that. They're losing all credibility with all sections of the population, all sections of it. This is a contradictory development. We understand the terrible, dangerous, negative, fascist part of it. But we must also understand that it's blood in the water for capitalism. What we were taught as Marxist-Leninists, was that when there is trouble in the ruling class, the big trouble such as that which exists today, what should the working class do if it's revolutionary, the workers and the oppressed? They should see if there's a way that they can exploit it in the interests of the class struggle. They shouldn't just sit on the sidelines and watch ping pong, you know, and just be out of it. You let somebody else make the decisions over their life and what happens. That's not the solution. They certainly shouldn't depend on another capitalist party to save them, which is the problem that we're going to be dealing with. We're always dealing with it, but we're going to be dealing with it big time in 2018. They should find a way to intervene. All revolutions, to one extent or another, including the Russian Revolution, the French Revolution, all of them, to one extent or another, it was the revolutionary forces at some point exploiting a split or some kind of breakdown in the ruling class, whether it was a feudalist ruling class or whether it's a capitalist ruling class. Hello, that's what's happening right now. Excuse me. And it's happening on a global level. This is painful and dangerous, but underneath it, comrades and friends, it's good news. If, and only if, the workers and the oppressed of this country are trying to find a way to take advantage of it, to undermine imperialism and capitalism and find a way to the road to revolution. So when we admonish each other to build the party, any way it's done is fine. Out of exuberance, that's good. We'll take that. But there are other ways. And what I'm trying to describe, perhaps inarticulately, is that as we grow, we must understand that we're not separate, but we're a reflection of something that's going on in our class. And to realize that is to understand the new responsibility that we have. You have to go out and get more comrades. You can. We've shown that it's possible. If we can win this many people, we can win 100 times this many people. Who can disprove that? Who can disprove that? You couldn't say that 10 years ago. I don't think you could say that a few years ago. But no one can disprove. If we can win this many great revolutionaries, why can't we win 100 times more? Now that may be up to what we do or don't do. How much that is, I don't know. That's argumentative. But let's put it this way. Let's act like it's up to us. Let us go out and recruit like we've got nothing better to do. Like there's nothing more, that's it. Whatever else we're doing tremendous things. This growth is affecting our internal process. You know, a couple of comrades spoke to that. It's tremendous. It's exciting. It's necessary. And we'll be in the struggle. I don't want to speak to the specifics. What happens in January? What happens on May Day, International Women's Day? You know, what happens if there's a war? Hopefully, well, we must address all that. We better be ready to address all that, or we should get out the way and let somebody who's able to address it, address it. And I'm not sure there is anybody, so I guess we're stuck. But you comrades have to go back to your localities, and you have to recruit, recruit, recruit. And if this method is not effective, try another method. And if that method isn't effective, try another method and try and try and try and build this party and be responsible for our party realizing its full potential. That will be we're already in a period of transformation, but I think that will be the real transformation. Then we'll be able, perhaps, not just to be in solidarity with our comrades in People's Korea, but to tell them, don't worry, we will shut the war makers down. We'll shut them down. Venezuela, don't worry. There's no imperialist army going in there. The Marines are not landing there. We're not going to let them. We're not going to let them. And all the other oppressed around the world, we can tell them, listen, don't worry, do what you gotta do, whatever way you're gonna do it. But we are going to paralyze U.S. imperialism so that they can't continue to terrorize you. We've got to go out and win more queers. We got to go out and win more black people, more Latinx, more indigenous people, more women. What was Mon talking about? What's that category? We don't even use it that much. Lumpen, you know, right on, whatever. Capitalism is, from one point of view, capitalism is making more of us more and more lumpen by the day. How difficult is it to find a homeless person? You cannot walk down the street. We've got to organize these people. We have got to organize the prisoners. When they go on strike, even though we can't be with them in the cell, they've got to know that the working class is with them. The immigrant workers who are rotting in some jail, waiting to be deported, getting no health care, separated from their families,
living in fear. They've got to know that we may not be in the cell with them where we are in spirit, but we will tear down that cell. We will tear it down. Because ultimately, the Revolutionary Party, not only in this country, but everywhere, has to be a party of immigrants. When you weigh things pound for pound, the immigrants, workers, and it's a global phenomenon. You know, we don't even have to start talking about all the people, the thousands and tens of thousands who have died in the Mediterranean. I saw some documentary on, I don't know, one of the TV stations about them selling slaves in Libya. Look what they've done to Libya. What a crime. There's chattel slavery there. This is what's happening to the immigrants. Dark-skinned immigrants from Central Africa, from Nigeria. This is what imperialism has done to the world. Barbarism, I think some governments used to call it. We have got to go out and organize every section, and, you know, everybody's good. We got to get retirees. They've got a lot of time, and they've got a lot of skill, and they can do a lot. And if we don't go after them and recruit them, then somebody else will get them. And I don't think that whoever's getting them, even on the left, will be better than Workers' World. What do you think? We've got to get the disabled. We've got to go everywhere where people aren't even looking or not caring about sections of our class that are hidden, that have no voice, and say, come on in, come on in. And not only are we in solidarity with you, but you can help us. This, comrades, is the road to revolution, the best way that we know it. When will that revolution be? We can't tell. And there's probably a general feeling that it's no time in the near future, whatever that means. But I'll tell you, things move very fast in an economic and political crisis. You think the bourgeoisie thought they were going to get saddled with Trump 2 years ago? I don't think so. It hit them in the face like a brick. Other things can hit them in the face like a brick. So we don't have to promise ourselves or anybody else that we'll be erecting the revolutionary barricades and, you know, whatever, you know. We don't have to promise that. We may not be able to, you know, come up with that. On the other hand, we should keep our powder dry, because you never know. You never know. I'll end by reminding you of what Lenin did when he came back from exile in Germany. Sometime in the middle of 1917, was it April? He wrote the April Theses, you know. Large sections of the Bolshevik Party, they weren't for continuing the revolution. They thought, oh, we had a bourgeois revolution, and, you know, we don't have a big proletariat, and we have the peasantry, and we're not ready for socialism, and we've got to have a period of capitalist development. And Lenin said, no. Let's make the proletarian revolution. Let's win the peasants to our side. Let's do it. The ruling class is weak. Where are they weaker? What are we waiting for? We don't want to make the same mistake here. Build a workers' world.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.